It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss whether CVS Pharmacy's decision to end tobacco sales will have any impact on the number of smokers hoping to kick the habit.
First, we've all heard that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, but is it really?
Turns out there may not be that much science out there to back up the idea that breakfast is key, and there are a few new studies out that show it may not matter if you eat breakfast at all.
Here to talk about the new studies is Gretchen Reynolds. She's the phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog. Gretchen, welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me.
So a lot of us grew up on this notion that you got to start your day with breakfast. It's the, quote, most important meal of the day. So is that hogwash?
Well, that idea grew out of a lot of really very large studies that found that people who were thin tended to be people who also ate breakfast. And also people who were generally healthy tended to be people who ate breakfast. But those studies were what are known as associational studies, meaning one thing is associated with the other. People who eat breakfast tended to be thin. But it wasn't clear from those studies whether eating breakfast is what helped people to lose weight and remain thin and be healthy or not. So most of us grew up, including me, with the idea that you eat breakfast so that you are healthier, you're less likely to eat a huge lunch, just all those sorts of reasons that breakfast was, as you said, the most important meal of the day.
In your piece, you turn to a couple new studies that try to put that to a more direct test. What do they do? What do they find out?
These studies were what is known as randomized controlled studies, and that's the gold standard in science. It means that you take several groups of people and you have one group do something and the other group not do it. And in this case, perhaps the most important of the studies was looking at weight loss. And the scientists gathered about 300 people, which is a good-sized group, and had some of them eat breakfast, some of them not eat breakfast, and some of them do exactly what they'd been doing before. And they gave all the groups some information about what makes for healthy eating, what makes for a healthy breakfast. Then they checked in with them again after 16 weeks and to see whether they'd lost weight. All of them were hoping to lose weight. Basically, none of them had. And it made no difference if they ate breakfast or if they didn't eat breakfast or if they ate as they had before. So what that seems to tell us is, at least in this group, eating breakfast did not help people to lose weight.
So it's an interesting conclusion, given what we've all sort of accepted to be true about breakfast. Do you have any idea how the idea of virtue came to be associated with breakfast in the first place?
I think partly because people who eat breakfast tend to be people who are morning people and get up early and start doing a lot of things in the first place. And I think that's always been associated with virtue. But again, that's just an association. And what's interesting is one of the other studies that I wrote about in this column looked at whether people tended to eat a lot more later in the day if they didn't eat breakfast, and also whether their health was better if they ate breakfast. And again, they had people either start eating breakfast, eat breakfast, or not eat breakfast. And after 6 weeks, they didn't show any changes. They didn't show that the people who skipped breakfast then loaded up on huge lunches and dinners. Those people actually ate fewer calories over the course of the day than the people who ate breakfast. What's interesting is the people who ate breakfast did tend to move around more, and that may also be associated with virtue. But the upshot was the number of calories that the people took in and that they used up over the course of the day were almost exactly the same, whether they ate breakfast or whether they didn't.
Well, we had a theory from Mitchell on Facebook. He writes, this concept comes from farm workers, which until a generation ago, most of us were. Now that people don't do as much physical work anymore, we need less breakfast. So we don't need that farmhand fuel that we used to need in this culture.
I think that's perfectly plausible. But again, that actually needs to be tested scientifically to see if that is true. I'd also love to see things like the studies that I write about did not look at whether one type of breakfast is better than another type of breakfast. There haven't been a lot of good studies looking at that. Is it better to eat cereal or eggs or skip breakfast? We just don't really know. A lot of this is just myth.
So in these studies, we don't know what the people ate. They could have eaten a Grand Slam breakfast at Denny's. Is that the idea? Or they could have had a bowl of yogurt?
Well, in this case, the people in both of these studies were given information about what is believed to constitute a healthy breakfast, which would be not hugely high fat, not hugely high sugar, but a mix of carbohydrates, protein, some fruit. Then they were allowed to eat whatever kind of breakfast they wanted. So we don't really know whether there's a big difference in the outcomes if you eat, say, oatmeal as opposed to the all Cheerio breakfast. Those things really need to be tested, and I hope they will be.
Well, I'm one of probably a zillion parents engaged in some form of breakfast war every morning. My thing is trying to make sure, oh, kids, you got to have fruit in the breakfast. I remember my dad and brother, the infamous toast wars that ran for, I think, 3 years of our childhood. Are we all just making this stuff up based on our inclinations? Is there any science on what kids should be eating for breakfast?
I wish there were a lot more, believe me, because I tell my son he has to eat these things, and if he actually looked for the scientific record, he wouldn't find it. There are some limited studies in kids showing that they do better in school if they've had some protein in the morning. But again, those studies are really small. Some of them are, as I said before, associational studies, not really good randomized experiments, and we need at some point to do those studies so we can actually tell parents with proof this is the healthiest way to feed your child. And I would love to have that information. I promise you I will write a column as soon as I see those studies.
Well, given what we know about breakfast based on these couple of studies here, is it reasonable to say, if you're going to get hungry mid-morning, eat breakfast? If you don't, it's okay to hold off until lunch.
I would say the science at this point says yes. I love breakfast. I can't go without. So I will continue to eat breakfast. If you have never eaten breakfast, you don't want to eat first thing in the morning, the science available right now seems to suggest that's probably fine.
What's a standard Gretchen Reynolds breakfast, Gretchen?
I love oatmeal. Yeah. I love oatmeal and a banana and fruit and often toast. I'm a big breakfast eater.
Science or no, that's what you're going to stick with?
For now, and I also, I'm sorry to say, I love bacon.
You and a lot of other people there.
Yeah. Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Gretchen Reynolds, phys ed columnist for the New York Times Well blog, joining us to discuss new studies on the importance of breakfast. Veronica, I try to get a fancier breakfast, but I always come back to a bowl of cereal and maybe fruit, just to set an example for the kids mainly.
My new thing that I have had almost every morning is eating an apple with walnuts. It tastes like apple pie.
Apple.
It's not standard, I know, but it's my new go-to breakfast.
No, that makes sense. Nuts, a little protein.
Yeah, it's tasty.
A little heft to the breakfast. I like it. Well, how about you? We've got a spot on the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts on breakfast and your ideal breakfast or lack of same. The pharmacy chain CVS is halting sales of tobacco products almost a month ahead of schedule. It's part of a branding overhaul that hopes will emphasize consumers a focus on health and wellness.
It's the first national pharmacy chain to end tobacco sales, and it means that e-cigarettes are also off the market. But will business decisions and market forces like this help people kick the habit, or will smokers just shop somewhere else?
Dr. Michael Fiore joins us now. He's director of the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Fiore, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, big news in the tobacco world, I imagine, with CVS, a big pharmacy chain, saying, hey, we get $2 billion from tobacco sales. We're going to stop selling them. But does this make a difference for people who are out there smoking? Is this going to lead anybody to quit?
Well, I think it makes a substantial difference for a lot of reasons. First, when you think about what pharmacies do, they're in the business of promoting health. And what a disconnect. A business that sells medicine and a variety of products to help us keep healthy, it just doesn't make sense to, in those same locales, to sell a product that, if used as directed, kills half of the people who use it. So I think this is an incredible step forward and a powerful statement that CVS is in the business of health, not in the business of selling products to kill half of the people that use them.
Well, to take it one step further, if we picture, you know, the cash register at a pharmacy, often there's some prime eye space there on those shelves currently devoted to cigarettes. They say, at least for at the outset, they're going to have boxes of a smoking cessation free pack. It's going to include coupons for smoking cessation products. Dr. Furey, what would you like to see in that packet that they'll hand out people who ask for it?
Well, what we know is that most smokers here in Wisconsin and across the United States now tell us they want to quit. In fact, more than 7 out of 10 smokers today say they want to quit. About half of smokers, more than 50%, try to quit every year. One challenge is most people are trying to quit on their own cold turkey and failing. And if you could quit on your own, more power to you. But for the majority of smokers today who are addicted to tobacco, they can benefit from counseling. They could benefit from the 7 FDA-approved medications. They could benefit from support structures. They can benefit from calling the quit line that's available in all 50 states at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They could benefit from accessing the National Cancer Institute's website, smokefree.gov. So my hope is that CVS is going to provide access to all of these treatment options, knowing that there won't be a one-size-fits-all to help all smokers to quit. And the more options that are science-based that we provide to smokers, the more of them who want to quit will be able to do so successfully.
Now, you're in the field of public health and tobacco and smoking. Have people in your line of work been lobbying pharmacies like CVS and Walgreens to take these products off the shelf, or is this just an unexpected freebie for you guys?
Well, I think that there has been a movement for really more than a decade to align pharmacy industry with this disconnect and to take away this disconnect that has pharmacies selling cigarettes. Many independent pharmacists took this action long before CVS. And many pharmacists who own their own stores have taken this action, and to all of those trailblazers, they're to be commended. But once one of the big kahunas, one of the big players in the pharmacy market, take such an action, and CVS is the second largest pharmacy chain in America, it really does make a powerful statement. And frankly, it challenges the other big players, particularly Walgreens, to take similar action. It really shines a light on other pharmacies like Walgreens and says, how can you be selling a product that's going to kill half the people that use it when you're in the business of promoting health?
Do you think Walgreens will be another shoe that drops in the next year or two?
I have no idea personally, but boy, if I were the leaders of Walgreens and Rite Aid and the other big pharmacy chains, I would be thinking long and hard about what they're in the business of promoting and how can they be left behind, particularly now that CVS has taken this important step forward.
Well, another big issue in the smoking world now, CVS says they're also not going to sell e-cigarettes. I know these have only been on the market for a little while, and I know the research is young on the impact they have. What do we know so far as about the concept of e-cigarettes as a tool against smoking addiction?
Well, you know, as you just said, E-cigarettes is probably the product that's gotten the most news with the least information to back that news up. And that's something that hopefully will get resolved over the next few years. But, you know, I'm a physician, and one of the primary tenets of medicine is a concept of do no harm. And I think that CVS took the right action. Since we don't know much about e-cigarettes, why put people at risk, particularly when there are options that have been determined by the FDA to be safe and effective, and particularly when there are the sorts of counseling options that could help smokers to quit. Will e-cigarettes ultimately be judged as a helpful option? Possibly. But at this point, we have no idea. And, you know, when I'm asked about this by e-cigarette companies, what I say to them is, if in fact your products are safe and effective for smokers to transition to, why not submit them to the FDA, do the kind of testing that is independent and allows an individual to make an informed judgment, and get your product approved as a substitute for smoking. And until the e-cigarette companies go to the FDA with evidence that show that these products are safe and effective, my approach is do no harm. Let's use agents and treatments that have been tested and don't hurt the people who use them.
So when we look at other nicotine replacement products, things like gum and patch that people are familiar with, they have had that kind of research and approval?
Without a question. They've been tested extensively by the FDA. And in fact, the FDA has now approved 7 separate medications, most of which are over-the-counter, like the nicotine products you just talked about, have approved them as safe and effective. And it's not just medicines we're talking about here. Anyone anywhere in America can pick up the phone and dial 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They'll get a counselor who's been trained to help them to quit every step of the way. Any smoker in America can get on their computer and dial www.smokefree.gov, and you'll get the National Cancer Institute's best science on using the web to quit successfully. Any smoker can talk to her doctor and say, help me to develop a quit plan and move forward to break free of tobacco addiction. Increasingly, physicians are trained and have the tools to do that. So we've got options out there, and I'm glad to hear that CVS is going to be promoting those science-based options so more people who want to quit can do that successfully, and that's almost all smokers in America today.
You mentioned developing that sort of personal quitting plan. Is it hard to get a one-size-fits-all approach? Do different things work for different smokers?
You know, smokers are people. They're individuals. They come to the table with a variety of different experiences, and they differ in terms of the type of smoker they are and the degree of dependence upon tobacco and nicotine they have. Some are incredibly dependent upon nicotine. They've got a physical dependence upon this powerful drug, and that's a different approach than an individual who smokes on weekends when they're consuming significant quantities of alcohol, and might have a different approach to helping them to quit. So it shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all. Just as with any other chronic disease we treat as physicians, and we talk about tobacco dependence now not as some bad habit, but as a chronic disease. And just as with diabetes or hypolipidemia or hypertension, there are now an arsenal of effective science-based treatments that could help people who have the chronic disease of tobacco dependence to put that disease in remission.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Fiore. He's director of the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health about the end of tobacco products at a major pharmacy chain.
And we hope you'll join our conversation. Are you a smoker? Were you buying your tobacco products at CVS? Who's stopping carrying those products? What is your decision to strip tobacco products from the shelves? What does that decision mean to you? And will you double down on the efforts to quit now? Does it nudge you in that direction? Or will you just take your money and your business somewhere else? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. CVS is the first major pharmacy chain to pull tobacco products off its shelves. We're talking with Dr. Michael Fiore about what impact, if any, that will have on smokers.
And we want to hear from you. Should pharmacies sell cigarettes and other tobacco products? Have you tried to quit smoking? Were you successful? What made the difference either way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Go to a caller now. We've got Steve on the line in Ashland. Steve, hi. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Great program, great content. I wanted to pass along, you had asked the doctor about if Walgreens was going to follow suit. I was at the local Walgreens in Ashland last evening, and I asked them that very question, and they were in the process, they said, of pulling off all their tobacco products within the week.
No kidding. So, just in that local Walgreens.
In the local Walgreens. Now, I didn't ask him if it was a corporate policy, but I'm assuming it is.
Steve, thanks for the call. I haven't heard any move, Dr. Fiore, for Walgreens to do that nationwide, as we were talking about earlier. Kind of surprised to hear a local branch doing that.
Yeah. Well, first, I think it's great that you asked your local Walgreens. Would they consider taking a similar policy? And they've already made a decision to do so. Corporate Walgreens has not yet made that corporate decision. But what the caller just described is the sort of action that will really make a difference. I went into the local CVS here in Madison and complimented the manager on the fact that his company had made this important corporate decision, and he told me that I was one of many, many individuals who have told leadership of local CVS stores across America that they are to be commended for making their pharmacy smoke-free. They're in the business for health, and this applies to Walgreens as well as every other pharmacy. I hope they do the right thing and make all of their pharmacies smoke-free.
Steve, thanks for the call and for sharing that. We'll go now to Gay in Madison. Gay, hi.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple of points I'd like to make. First, I quit smoking only, and I tried for years, only when I became pregnant. And I don't know whether it was the hormones, the pregnancy, or just my knowledge that I couldn't do this to the baby. But, that's what worked for me, finally, and I haven't gone back in 25 years. But my husband has a problem in that he would love to quit, and he was a chipper. He could just smoke socially for years, but now he's truly addicted. And so he tried the e-cigarettes, but now I don't think they're a cure at all because he tends to just use both.
Gay, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Fiore, is that something we see, or again, given limited research, that people might keep smoking cigarettes and the e-cigs?
Yeah, well, great point. First, ma'am, you quit for your baby, but you quit for yourself, and what a gift to both of you to be quit during pregnancy and to stay quit after you deliver. Your story is not an uncommon one of women able to successfully quit during pregnancy. There's an enormous proportion of those women who, though, relapse after they deliver. So you're a great model, and I commend you for that. To this issue of what's called dual use, both using e-cigarettes as well as using regular or combusted cigarettes. In fact, when we talk to people, this is the rule rather than the exception. People who end up using both e-cigarettes as well as traditional cigarettes. Some surveys say 70% of people who use e-cigarettes don't use them exclusively, but use them along with regular cigarettes. And that's really a tragedy from this perspective. If a person was thinking about quitting and instead started using e-cigarettes part-time but continued using the deadly combusted cigarettes, how unfortunate that individual's motivation to quit didn't lead to the healthy goal, and that is no combusted cigarettes.
Gay, good luck to your husband. Congratulations on quitting, and congratulations on the baby, a little late. Erica in Kewaskum is with us now. Erica, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have been quit for, I think, 13 months now. And the biggest thing that helped me was to just kind of know really how nicotine works in the body. I had purchased a bunch of products to help me try to quit, including an e-cigarette and some nicotine patches. And then I had read a book that really helped me understand how I react to nicotine and how my mind is addicted to it. And that I ended up not even using any of the patches or the e-cigarette, just quit cold the next day after 15 years of smoking a pack a day. And I was perfectly fine. Once I understood how it worked, it was great. But, the only problem being every once in a while, it obviously comes back up in my mind. And it's not helpful to be in places like Walgreens, picking up a prescription, walking through a checkout and seeing tobacco products there because it's so easy to just buy something.
Yeah.
Wow, Erica,
yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So that that availability to Erica a year after quitting, the temptation is there in the pharmacy.
Yeah. I mean, that Erica, what a great point. In your experience of going through these pharmacies and having the availability of the products being an unnecessary temptation is actually not an uncommon one. To the fact that you were able to quit on your own, more power to you. I think it's wonderful that you did that, and it's great that you, in essence, did some self-counseling, sought out resources to support you, these resources you used on your own via the book that you purchased, and that is great. We talked earlier, there doesn't have to be a one-size-fits-all. Whatever you can do as an individual to get off of this product that sadly is going to kill half of the people addicted to it. Nationwide now, 500,000 Americans are killed every year from tobacco, and we almost get numbed by those numbers, but for every one of those, there's a child that has lost a parent, there's a brother who has lost a sibling, there is a friend who has lost a loved one. These are people whose lives are being cut short because of addiction to a deadly drug that sadly is legal.
Erica, thanks a lot for the call. It sounds like Erica effectively quit on her first try. That's not the norm. I think a lot of people, it takes a couple of times. How do you recommend people get over maybe a sense of discouragement, of failure, if they try once and don't quit? They try again and they don't quit.
Yeah, great point. And just to normalize this, the average smoker takes between 4 and 5 attempts to successfully quit, but it ranges from 1 up to 100 or more for some people. You know, when I tell people who've tried, you've learned something. You're smarter as a result of having tried, and with that knowledge, you can be stronger. And the statistics tell us that the more times you try, the more likely you are to quit. So don't give up. You can do this. You'll get smarter and stronger with every effort. You can break free of tobacco dependence.
We'll leave it with those words of encouragement. Dr. Fiore, thanks for joining us.
Good talking with you.
This is Dr. Michael Fiore. He's director of the Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about the pharmacy giant CVS's decision to take tobacco off the shelves a month ahead of schedule. It's time for this week's edition of Share Something. As more and more TV shows end up on DVD or on-demand services, the art of binge-watching, plowing through multiple episodes, maybe even seasons at our own pace, is on the rise.
Recent weeks have seen the release of seasons from programs old and new, Dynasty and The Walking Dead, Doctor Who and Parks and Recreation, as well as the new remastered things possibly on the horizon, including HBO's The Wire.
It's a binge-watching world, but what should we watch next? Christopher John Farley has some ideas for us. He's senior editor at The Wall Street Journal, and he's the author of Game World. Christopher, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, when you have a big screen at home, you get iTunes, Netflix, DVDs, why leave your own home to go to a sticky movie theater someplace to watch a movie? Watch it at home.
Well, and we are, for the most part, it seems like. What makes a TV show bingeable?
Well, bingeable, one, you want it to be set in the distant past or the future, because that helps sort of suck you into this sort of whole new world. It's also good if it's set on, you know, in distant lands like Outlander or some world you've never been to before, you know, like Rome, which we'll talk about. It's also great if it has extreme morality, you know, Breaking Bad, House of Cards, some of the folks on Orange is the New Black, because that somehow also transports us when we see these folks, these characters, that have a moral code that's there, but it's somewhat different from the moral code that we expect in our normal everyday lives that helps take us out of there. It's also great when the shows have sort of fascinating, kind of wide-ranging casts of characters, lots of people that we get to know over the course of multiple seasons.
What is your preferred way to find out about the best binge-watching shows, besides asking Christopher John Farley?
Well, I have two kids. I ask them. I ask their friends, what's going on? What are you watching? You know, you find out at parties. You find out from things that get sent to you at work. You check them out and say, this, is that going to work? And it happened with Outlander recently. I mean, I got sent this show, Outlander, from Starz. I thought, what is this about? I had some friends back in college used to read the Outlander books, and I'd never really sort of given them much thought. But I immediately got sucked into this world. It's about this nurse in World War II who gets transported back to the Scottish Highlands in 1743 and goes off on this sort of romantic time-traveling adventure. And it sounds like a weird setup, but it just pulls you in and you want to know more about this world, and set in real history and based on some very popular books. And there are only 4 episodes so far, but I'm recommending you binge on them immediately, because they really suck you in.
Well, I've got some friends and family members very excited, who love the books, very excited about this TV show. We've got a clip now. This is the time-traveling World War II nurse trying to interfere with the Scottish tax collector of the time she travels to.
Hey, where do you think you're taking that?
Back to her owners. The family needs her.
The goods ours. We're taking our wares.
The hell you are.
That's goods and chattels. Has to be accounted for.
How can he know? She's stoken drunk.
I am no such thing.
You'll be giving me the goat.
Go!
Where did you find her?
Away in Cock-a-Doodle-Deed.
How hard is it to keep watch on Assassin Agwenchi?
She's slippery as an eel, laugh on Doodle.
Would you stop talking about me as if I'm not here? There's a baby that needs milk.
Stop your havering, woman. The beast is payment for rent. Fair and square.
So you let a child go hungry?
So she's trying to take their goat, and they really got her goat there. How do you keep track? The Scottish accent was throwing me in the clips I was watching, Christopher.
You know, the Scottish accent is strong, but it's worth powering your way through. And this show also is one of the best theme songs in all of TV. It's an adaptation of the Skyboat song, which is a traditional Scottish song. The lyrics are, sing me a song of a lass that is gone. The minute you hear that song, it places you within the context, the cultural context of the show, and you're off and running.
And do you get better with the Scottish accents? I could practically see the tartan, but I couldn't always understand the words.
Well, you know, that's what closed captions are for. You put those on, I don't think you have a problem.
It's a good idea. All right, so we've got Outlander. And that one's, by the way, is that on Netflix? Probably not yet, right? Only on Starz?
Yeah, it's on Starz, but if you have Starz on Demand, you can catch up on past episodes. If you have a friend with Starz on Demand, go over there and hang out. Bring some wine. Go for it.
All right, well, what else you got? What else should we be watching?
You know, Battlestar Galactica. Now, my wife does not like science fiction. She's not into science fiction. She, to humor me and to keep our marriage strong, she decided to watch the show with me. And, man, she was hooked. We watched all the episodes. Now, this isn't the Battlestar Galactica from 1978 with Lauren Green. This is the cool futuristic remake that came out in 2004 with Edward James Olmos and Mary McDonnell. Great top-notch acting, smart shows that explored notions of heroism and God and other aspects of human existence. Really a terrific show that really pushed the boundaries of what great TV sci-fi can do. If you watch the show, even if you don't like sci-fi, you'll get pulled in. And the way that a lot of people get pulled into Game of Thrones that didn't like fantasy, you'll get pulled into Battlestar Galactica, the reboot, even if you don't like sci-fi.
We've got a little taste of that one. Here it is.
This is likely to be a one-way trip, so don't volunteer out of sentiment or emotion. There is a line running down this deck. Volunteers, move to the starboard side. Everyone else to the port.
So Edward James Olmos is Commander Adama, and he holds the show together from my watching of it. He's the guy who gave it the gravitas, and just not your typical inspirational leader, but I'd follow him somewhere.
Exactly. I mean, gravitas is the perfect word for what he brings to the show and what the show has. I mean, it's a sci-fi show with gravitas, and also I think at the heart of it, exploring that notion of what it means to be human. I mean, Earth is humans in the future are attacked by intelligent machines. They're looking for a new home, and along the way, they really have to grapple with the idea of what's the difference between humans and thinking machines, and how can we perhaps live together? And I think obviously these are issues that have been explored in like everything from 2001 to Terminator. These are issues that we're dealing with now in terms of what's happening with computers and the advances they're showing. We're soon going to come to the age of probably thinking machines. And this show does it. It's very, very interesting, very entertaining. It'll suck you in.
Now, another sci-fi one that people are really nuts about that I haven't gone too deep into is Firefly. Are you a fan of that one?
You know, Firefly is a strong show. I have watched it. I didn't get pulled into it in the way that I got pulled into Battlestar Galactica, because Firefly, again, there are some very rabid fans of the show. Firefly,
Joss Whedon, one sitting right here.
Me, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little lighter. It's a little more adventurous. It's a little more fun. Battlestar Galactica, while fun, does have the gravitas you talked about. It does take itself a little seriously in a way that Firefly does not.
Well, another one you recommended that I haven't seen, but I keep hearing good things about from the BBC, I think, Orphan Black. What's the deal with that one?
Okay, here's the deal with Orphan Black. I don't want to tell you anything about Orphan Black because it's a lot more fun to be taken on the thrill ride as you watch it. I mean, I will have a little bit of a spoiler in that it involves clones, but the clones in a really sort of fun way. It also doesn't take itself too seriously. It's an adventure. It's a soap opera. It's a thriller. There's sci-fi elements. There's some religious elements, too. And there's a great central performance by Tatiana Maslany, who plays the lead. And she plays various clones who have grown up in different places, have different kind of ethnic and not so much ethnic, but different social backgrounds. And so they have fun with that. It's a great acting job by her, and it really kind of centers the whole enterprise.
So I got to ask you about one that I haven't seen, but I'm really excited about it, a show called Rome.
You know, Rome, again, I talked about how it's great when shows are set in the distant past or in extreme morality. And we think, sometimes think of Rome as sort of this, you know, the Roman Empire is a boring thing we read about in high school. But, you know, Rome recreates it and shows how alien the moral code of Rome was, of traditional classic Rome, compared to what we expect today in terms of the sex, in terms of the politics, in terms of the assassinations. And it's set during the time of Julius Caesar's assassination, around that period there, into the rule of Caesar Augustus. And we get to see this through the eyes of two ordinary Roman soldiers. And it's fascinating to see these events that have take place from the eyes, from the point of view of ordinary Romans, and we get taken into this new world that we're seeing afresh through the eyes of this TV series.
Well, here, those two soldiers are at this speech as Julius Caesar rallies his troops for a march on Rome.
Our beloved Republic is in the hands of madmen. This is a dark day, and I stand at a fork in the road. I can abide the law and surrender my arms to the Senate and watch the Republic fall to tyranny and chaos. Or I can go home with my sword in my hand and run those maniacs to the Tarpeian Rock!
Spoiler alert, he does that second thing.
The Tarpeian Rock factors
yeah,
in.
He takes over Rome for a while. Oops, spoiler.
Yeah, what I love about this, I mean, many of us have seen the movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe, and that's a fine movie, but it only is about 2.5-3 hours long. He wants to show like Rome that unfolds. It was on the air from 2005 2007. You get multiple episodes to sort of build up the Roman culture then, to get to know these characters, get to see these historical events take place, and it's a much richer novelistic kind of experience than you'd get from just watching a 2-3 hour movie.
Christopher, what's the longest marathon you've ever had binge watching?
You know, we watched every episode of Battlestar Galactica together, my wife and I. Almost every night we watched it all the way up to the final episode, which we then saw that they had a special screening in New York, and so Edward James Olmos was actually there.
Wow.
So it's kind of fun to sort of spend a month watching the show, every season, every episode, and finally the day before the last episode was released to the public, we got to go see it with some of the stars. So that was a really cool thing. And what's cool about that is it's an immersive experience when you binge watch. There are details you catch that you wouldn't catch if you're watching it from week to week. There's some instant gratification in that when there's a cliffhanger, you know, the next day or the next hour, you'll get to see what happened with that cliffhanger rather than you have to wait for the next season to come on. So it's a cool thing to binge watch. But the downside is, with binge watching, is the long wait for another season to come on.
That's a problem.
So when half the season of Mad Men's over, you still got like 6 months before they bring it back again. And that can drive you literally crazy.
I know, it's bittersweet. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Christopher John Farley, senior editor at the Wall Street Journal and author of Game World.
Rounding out his list, he suggested Sleeper Cell, Spartacus, and for the kids, Avatar, The Last Airbender. You can also share your binge watch favorites now over at the Central Time Facebook page.
What are you watching right now?
We're watching the... I can't think of the name of it.
The really good TV show. I'm watching Glee right now. I don't know what you're watching, but that's a pretty good
The Transcontinental
one.
Railroad. Hell on Wheels. There it is.
Gotcha. Okay.